This presentation is brought to you by iAwaken.org, a not-for-profit organization. We hope you enjoy the presentation. Please observe the copyright terms to which you have agreed.
Friday, July 7th, Rabbi David Lappin, Lady Shear.
Good morning, ladies. So once again, next week I will not be late because I won't be here, but the week after I will also not be late. And I will be here.
Just so you're here.
Sorry?
Just so you're here.
No, we can talk about time management.
I don't think we can. All right.
We must confront people, Mrs. Crane.
I'm not going to confront him. I'm just saying better that he's here than not here. Where will we find Shir HaShirim?
We'll find Shir HaShirim in the Tanakh, in most at the back of most Chumashim, usually at the end of.
Right now it's in the art school right after candlelight.
This time you'll find it in every siddur after candle lighting. You'll find it. It's set up on Shabbos, and you'll find it in most chumashim if you want it with the. Is there in the art school? They even have a bit of a parish at the bottom, probably a translation. And so that's the best. An art school siddur.
All right.
An art school siddur is just after the candle lighting on Shabbos is a good place to find it. Yeah, and it's important to try and remember to bring it with so that you have a text in front of you. The first sentence is not that dissimilar from most of the other books that Shlomo writes from Solomon, in that he tells us right at the outset who the author is. And his first sentence is Shir HaShirim Asher L'Shlomo. This is the Song of Songs. It doesn't say written by Shlomo. It's an interesting phrase. Asher L'Shlomo, which belongs to Shlomo, which belongs to King Solomon. This is King Solomon's Song of Songs. It's not that he wrote it for you. He wrote it for himself. This is his Song of Songs. But what's different here from the others is that he doesn't introduce himself as Shlomo ben David, as Shlomo the son of David, which is his biggest claim to fame, that he is the disciple and son of King David. That's his source of authority. And these works, as with many others, start with the authority, because as we discussed, those of you who were at the Shabbat Pirkei Avot Shir will remember that we discussed that before the Vilna Gaon says, before you study anything, make sure that in your eyes the author is an authority. Because if in your eyes the author is not an authority, you will not accord him the respect of struggling with new ideas. If he proposes something new, bless you, if he proposes something new, you'll discard it, you'll reject it. And you will only allow yourself to be challenged by new thinking if you believe that he's the authority in that particular field and you want to study what he says. So for example, Kohelet, the book of Kohelet starts Divrei Kohelet Ben David. These are the words of Kohelet Ben David, the son of David, Melech Yerushalayim, the king of Jerusalem. And Kohelet deals with the pursuit of pleasure and trying to find meaning in the pursuit of pleasure. And so he says, I'm Shlomo, the son of David. I was raised in a palace. I lived in Jerusalem at Israel's most prosperous time. There is nobody more authoritative than me on the worlds of pleasure and what's available, because everything that was available I had access to. And he begins his journey examining all the different things that are available. And here he introduces himself, but not as saying Divrashna, these are the words of Shirashim, this is the song of songs. Actually, Shlomo, it's a song of songs, it's not Solomon's song of songs, it is the song of songs. Period. This is the song of songs. Asher Shlomo, written by Shlomo, it's the song of Shlomo. He doesn't mention his father, because he's not dealing with physical issues here. This is the most spiritual of all the books that have been written. This is the most spiritual of all the books of the Tanakh. This is the most spiritual work of poetry that's ever been written. And that's why it's called Shir Hashirim, the Song of Songs. But all songs, all poetry have a romantic spiritual dimension to them. But this is Shir Hashirim, this is the Song of Songs, because it is entirely romantic and spiritual. There is nothing physical about it, there's nothing material about it. And it probes the man-god relationship at the deepest level. And therefore his father was as irrelevant. It's who he is and what his soul is. It's his connection to God rather than his connection to his father that gives him the authority to write this particular work. And we're going to do it as we have the various other things that we've studied, not just as an exercise in studying this particular text, but as using this text, using the experiences of Shlomo as they express themselves in Shir Hashirim, to understand more about the Torah, more about life, how Shlomo sees life, with particular emphasis on the man-god relationship and the man-woman relationship, which he uses as the image. As we said last week, that the parallel goes both ways. If he's using the man-woman relationship to illustrate the man-god relationship, then there will also be lessons that we can get from the man-god relationship that will impact on the man-woman relationship. And how it is strange that the relationship which of all relationships is the most of all relationships is the most sensual and the most physical, the man-woman relationship, is chosen by Shlomo as being the vehicle to most accurately epitomize the relationship between man and God. And we're going to try and understand why. Rashi says, why is this the Song of Songs? And he says, this is quoting from Gemara and Midrashim. I'm going to work through the whole Rashi with you because it contextualizes Shir Hashirim so beautifully. Shami Rav is saying, our rabbis learned, Kol Shlomo Ha'amurim B'Shir Hashirim. Whenever the word Shlomo appears in Shir Hashirim, don't read it Shlomo the king and Shlomo the author, but read it Kodesh, read it as Shalom, Melech Shah Shalom Shalom, the king of peace, the king, the master of peace. So it has a double meaning. You won't remember because I did it in South Africa when we learned the book of Esther, and whenever it says king in Esther, whenever it says Melech, it has a double meaning. It refers to Ahasuerus and it refers to Hashem, and you've got to learn it with that double meaning all the time. It's brilliantly written. But every time, if it says Melech Achashverosh, that means Achashverosh. But if it says Melech, and it says Melech many, many times, in the Megillah that I used to use in South Africa, it was a Megillah of each column was 13 lines long. So you can imagine there were lots of columns. And every column, excepting one or two, the first and one or two others, started with the word Melech. So it was written in such a way, it was a very special way of writing a Megillah, 13 lines per column. And every column starting with the word Melech, and each time the word Melech was used, it was a beautiful crown, a different crown every time was drawn, was very described. It was brilliant. But that's how many times the word Melech comes, and each time you learn it in double meaning. It means, in the immediate context of King Ahasuerus, it's talking about a story, and it means that, and it also means God. And it's very fascinating to learn that double meaning all the way through, because that's really life. That all the time you put it in, you get everything in a double meaning. You can't look at it just as God, and you can't take God out of the equation. Everything that happens, that's happening, you're looking at it in a double way. And Shir Hashirim, we're going to do the same. Wherever the word Shlomo comes, we're talking about God and Shlomo. We're learning it on two levels. So Shir Hashirim and Asher Shlomo means what? It means this is the Song of Songs that possessed, mastered by Shlomo. And this it means this is God's Song of Songs. This is the Song of Songs that God writes and sings, and this is God's own song. Shir shuhu al kol hashirim asher ne'amar la'kodesh baruch hu. This is the song that is over all songs that have ever been said to God, says Rashi. Me'es adosoi v'amoi Knesset Yisrael, from the time that the Jewish people were formed and started writing songs to God, this one is above all of them. Amar Rabbi Akiva, Rabbi Akiva said, I think it's Rabbi Akiva, the great Rabbi Akiva, one of the the great intellects of all times. Lo haya ha'olam kedai kiyom shenisan bo shir hashirim l'Yisrael. The world was never so worthwhile as the day on which shir hashirim was given. That was one of the most important moments in the world. Shekol ha'ksuvim kodesh. Well, you'll say, what about Sinai? What about there were other times that were more important to Rabbi Akiva? No. Shir HaShirim has a special importance because all the other things that have been written are Kodesh, they're holy. But Shir HaShirim Kodesh Kodoshim, but this is holy of holies. There is nothing so holy as Shir HaShirim. Amar Rabbi Elazar ben Azariah. Rabbi Elazar ben Azariah tried to explain it, and he said, Lama Adela Dona, what can this be compared to? Lamelech Shanota So'ach Chitim. A king takes a measure of wheat. When the son of the Nachtam, he takes it to the baker. Amalin, he says to the baker, in those days the bakers and the millers, the baker used to mill. Hotzeli kach bekach solis. Produce from this a certain amount of raw flour. Kach bekach subin. And take another measure of finer flour. Kach bekach mursin, and still finer flour. But from all, once you've refined it and refined it and refined it, take from me out of the purest flour and make me only one loaf of bread out of this ton of wheat. I just want one loaf of bread made from the finest of the flour. And that kind of proportion, and he uses the Elizabeth Azariah uses the image of the baker. I suppose we South Africans can appreciate it more when you see how gold is produced. That the tip of a teaspoonful of gold comes from a ton of rock. That's the proportion of raw rock that has to be dug out of the ground, blown out of the ground, moved by toil and labor, and put into carts and taken miles up to the top, and then crushed and then processed and milled and all sorts of things to get the tip of a teaspoonful of gold powder. That's the relationship, and I've always used the gold relationship as a life example. Out of a ton of human beings, you'll get a teaspoon tip of nobility. That's how many people you have to go through before you find the special one. Out of a ton of relationships, you've got to go through and you've got to refine them, and you've got to work them, and you've got to work them because you won't get it if you don't. You can't say, all I want is the teaspoon tip. All you want is the teaspoon tip. You won't get the teaspoon tip. You've got to go down in that mine. You've got to go down 2 miles underground where it's hot and terrible. And you've got to mine, and you've got to chop, and you've got to move, and you've got to go away, and you've got to get the stuff out and bring it to the surface. And when you've finished all that, you'll have your teaspoon tip. But if you want the teaspoon tip without doing all that, you're not going to get it. The only way to get it is to pay a lot of money, which is why gold is expensive. But that money represents your toil in your area. So you toil and toil and toil to be able to earn enough money to be able to buy the gold. At the end of the day, you're not going to get that little bit of gold without that toil. And that's why it was an Azari's example here with something that's more universal than gold, and that's bread. That you can refine and refine and refine. And a soil is about a ton. It's an enormous amount of wheat to get that perfect loaf of bread that has been produced to get that. Now, is that elitist? Of course it's elitist. The Torah happens to be elitist. It is elitist. The Torah accepts that you need to work through lots of mess in order to get the cream. And nature is elitist. And the world is elitist. Cream rising to the top. It's always you need bulk in order to get that little bit of really rich content. And there's no area in the world where that doesn't apply. Except in modern democracy, we've tried to pretend that it doesn't apply, but it does apply, and it applies in this country as in every other country as well. At the end of the day, the people who really make the difference, the people who really run the place, the people who are really great in their fields, it's a tiny little fraction of people, it's like that in every society. It's just how it is, and it's accepted. The ratio in yeshiva is considered, the Gemara says, is 1 to 1,000. You have to take 1,000 people into the yeshiva to try and produce one outstanding person. And you can't say my yeshiva will only be for the outstanding ones, because the ratio is, you know, they talk about the 80-20. We don't have an 80-20, we have a 1 to 1,000. But you've got to accept that you're going to deal with 1,000 mediocre people to get the one. And that's the kind of ratio. You're going to go through 1,000 experiences to get the precious experience. And in every area of life, you can't escape the toil with the bulk to be able to distill the cream, because it's a distillation process. And if you don't have the bulk to start with, you can't possibly get to the distillation. Where it's not elitist, the Torah is, it's open to everybody. Nobody says who's going to be the cream. You take 1,000 boys into the yeshiva, it's not predetermined which one is going to be the cream. It's open to anybody. Anybody who makes the effort could be that cream, but experience proves that it's 1 in 1,000 that does it. That's the kind of ratio that it is, because that's the kind of ratio that seems to work. And so it is here. Kach kolak suvin kodesh, v'shir ashurim kodesh kodoshim. So it's almost as if shir ashurim is the distillation of sanctity drawn out of everything else that was ever written. So while we've got the whole Torah, and the Torah is pretty dense and intense as it is, but shir ashurim is the concentrate of the Torah, taking the most concentrated sanctity out of the Torah and putting it into one song and creating that loaf of bread. That's shir ashurim, explains Rashi. Why is that? Shekulo yirah shemayim v'kibul ol malchuso, because it is all about yirah shemayim, normally translated as God fearing, and I'm going to redefine that, v'kibul ol malchuso, and the acceptance of the yoke of his kingdom, which doesn't sound all that romantic, does it? So after we've now built this up, if this is all and this beautiful thing, and what is it all about? Fearing God and accepting yoke. And this is heavy stuff. It's not light and liberating, and yet this is where it's all at. So we need to understand that, and we understand it in the second sentence, which is Yishokeni min ashikos pihu. Let him kiss me with the kisses of his mouth. Ki tovim dodecho miyoyin. Because, now this word dodecho is a complicated one. I'm firstly going to translate it as I would imagine they do there in the English, and that is because your love is better than wine. Is that what they said? How they translated there? Ki tovim dodecho miyoyin. The love of you is better than wine. Okay. Your friendship, is it saying? And that friendship is nice, except not quite intimate enough. So if it was your intimate friendship is better than wine, that would be okay. Or your love, does art course say love? Is that how they translate it? So they'll take yain as the epitome of earthly delights. Why wine as the epitome of earthly delights? What is it about wine that is so delightful? If you have too much of it. But the thing is, the impact it has on you. Most earthly delights stay outside of you. Wine changes you. Mm. Changes the way you see the world. It changes the way you feel about yourself. You can be miserable. You can be dull. You can be down. A couple of glasses of wine, and all of a sudden the world's not such a bad place. And that's why wine is taken as the image. Now again, let's work this in both relationships. So in the man-woman relationship, what is he saying? Because that love, that intimacy, that companionship works like wine. It makes me feel different about myself. That's what's important about that relationship. And what's important when young people are getting involved in shidduchim, and something that I often talk about, is what you need to examine is not whether you love her and whether she loves you. That's easy, and you could love lots of people. What's important is, how do you feel about the way you love yourself when you're with her, and vice versa? How does she feel about herself? Because there are lots of people that love the other person, but when they're together feel awful about themselves. Have you ever heard of such situations? In abusive relationships, you've got that. And that's why they stick. He makes me feel terrible, and he's abusive. I love him. There's the possibility of that contradiction. And therefore, loving him or loving her is not a basis to get together. You can love a dog.
That's not real life.
Sorry?
That's not real life.
Sometimes it's so real that they resent it enormously if you try and interfere and help them. Ireland's got into
turn. It's not love.
Well, it depends what you want to call that.
That's a sickness to be attracted.
It's obsession.
It's kind of an obsession. Yes, to somebody who treats you not.
You're right. So it's a kind of obsession. But it's very difficult sometimes for the person in love to know whether he or she is in love or an obsession. And one of the tests is, how do you feel about yourself when you're together? Mm-hmm. That That's the real test. Not how do you feel about the other person, because you can feel crazy about another person who is destructive. Hitler, people loved him. People were crazy about him. It doesn't mean the other person is worthwhile because you love the other person. You might be kicking into something, who knows what the chemistries are. People say, you know, there needs to be a chemistry. Well, a chemistry can make a nuclear bomb as well. A chemistry doesn't mean that the result is constructive. The result of chemistry can be destructive. What's important is, how do I feel about myself when I'm together? So Yayin is the example of a physical thing, something outside of me that has the capacity to change the way I feel about myself. But as much as wine can do that, love can do that even better, and the love of God can do that best of all. If we really are able to link into the love of God and to experience that, what that should do is change the way I feel about myself, not the way I feel about God. And if it's not doing that, one has to question it. And that's what Shlomo HaMelech is saying here. And Rashi points out, he says that what I'm looking for in my relationship to God is the kisses of his mouth. I'm not looking for courtesy. Says Rashi, there's some places where people kiss this. You kiss your hand, and there's some places where they'll peck at your cheek. That's not what he's talking about. He's talking about an intimacy that is of the highest order, and that's what he wants with God. Not a courteous relationship, not a relationship where we greet each other warmly, but where there's enormous intimacy. Medrash talks about the moment of that kiss was Sinai. That's where God kissed us. That's where there was physical contact. That's the only time that we as a nation have had intimate physical contact. But we have survived on that and been nourished by that all of this time. And it's that for which the craving that is expressed in Shir HaShirim is the same. That craving for the kind of intimacy that we experienced on Sinai and we want to experience again. That is a Gemara that is on the surface quite disturbing. Again, can you think of anything more beautiful and intimate and romantic than talking about the relationship to God in this particular sentence and in this particular imagery, and saying the love of you is more precious than wine, than any earthly delights, than anything that one can experience here? And the Medrash says, this means chavivim divrei sofrim miyena shel Torah. When wine is used, it's often used as an image for Torah, because Torah is intoxicating, and that's sometimes difficult for people to fully appreciate unless they've learned Torah. And learning Torah doesn't mean what we're doing now. We are learning Torah, but that's not the intoxicating part of it. The intoxicating part of it is really where you're able to immerse yourself for hour after hour, allowing your mind to explore to move right to the limits of human thinking, and to probe God's intellect in the framework of Torah. And that's the kind of learning that is supposed to take place in yeshiva, the kind of learning that is supposed to take place when one's learning Gemara on a deep level. That is intoxicating. That is absolutely intoxicating. And it has the effect on one of a good glass of wine. It is totally, it's almost sensual. And when the word yayin is used, when the word wine is used, it's always used as Torah. And the Gemara says this statement, Tovim Dodecha. Dodecha doesn't only mean your love and so on. Dodecha also means your beloved. So the word Dod, which means an uncle, Dod means a companion, Dod means a beloved. The word David, the name David, comes from that, God's beloved one, God's companion, God's beloved one. So Kitovim Dodecha Miyayin. If we now translate Dodecha as your beloved ones are better than wine, what are we now saying? Your beloved ones are better than Torah. What are your beloved ones? Says the Gemara, the laws of the rabbis are more precious than the words of the Torah. And in here we have a very important insight into a whole aspect of the Torah and of our relationship to God. The laws of the rabbi are more precious, the rabbis are more precious than the Torah itself. How can that be? What does it mean? How often do you hear people say, oh, that's just the law of the rabbis? Or, you know, is this the Torah or is this just the law of the rabbis? And here we're saying, Now King Solomon says, as precious as the Torah is, the law of the rabbis is even more important. Why? Rabbeinu Yonah, an important thinker of the Middle Ages, writes the following in Pirkei Avot, in the beginning of Pirkei Avot. In Pirkei Avot it says you must make a fence around the Torah. The fence around the Torah are the laws of the rabbis. The Torah says you can't write, the rabbis say you can't handle a pencil or a pen on Shabbos. And so on. All the laws of the Torah says you can't do this, the rabbis say not even that. And Rabbeinu Yonah says, quote, based on the Gemara, Hasyag, a fence, that's the laws of the rabbis, who dovo godo l'mashubach la'asos gedo mitzvahs, to make a fence around the mitzvahs is a great thing to do, l'bal yuchal l'hikasher bohem ha'yoreis devar Hashem, so that one who fears God will not come near to do anything wrong. L'chein ha'mekayim divrei chachamein uzal, therefore fulfilling the laws of the rabbis, which are the fences around the mitzvahs, Chibev ha'yiro yoseh m'misho oseh ha'mitzvah atzmo, shows more value of God fearing than one who actually does the mitzvah. So doing the mitzvah is not as God fearing as preserving the fence around the mitzvah. Can you understand that? Ki ein asiyas ha'mitzvah v'chocho l'yiro, because doing the mitzvah does not mean you're God fearing. Because if a person does a mitzvah, it shows he loves to do the mitzvah, but it won't be the end of the world if he slips up. But where you build a fence around it, you're actually saying, I don't want to come even close to slipping up on this. This is so important that I'm building in a mechanism to make sure that I don't come close to slipping up. And that's the world of ours. We don't do that ourselves. We don't build our own fences. That the Chachorim have done that. And then he says, because divrei chachorim zal, the words of the rabbis, saying yisodos ve'ilonos liyirashamayim, these are the foundations and the trees of yirashamayim, God fearing. We'll discuss that. Shehu ikar ha'olam ve'yisod ha'ma'alam, and yirashamayim is the root of the world and the foundation of greatness. Interesting. What does all that mean? Yiro, God fearing. Why is that the root of the world and the foundation of greatness? We know that there are two forces in the Torah, Ava and Yira, love of God and fear of God. And then one of the Monday night Shirim, on the first one on the commandment of Shabbos, the fourth commandment, you remember I spoke about Yira being the restraining force, Yira being the contractionary force, and Ava being the expansive, the generous force. And that we're constantly, these two forces operate all the time. That there are times when we have to be out there, creative, expansive, generous, and there are times where we have to be contractionary and inward. Yira is the contractionary part. And generally it's assumed that Ava is greater than Yira, that serving God out of love is better than fear, serving out of fear, and so on. Here we have in Rabbeinu Yonah and in Shir HaShirim a concept that Yira has something to it, and since it's in Shir HaShirim it relates to intimacy. But when we're looking at intimacy with God, Yira, God fearing, has something that nothing else has. And that doesn't seem to, that seems a little bit counterintuitive. One would think that love is more intimate than fear. Why would fear be more intimate than love? What is there about fear that could be more intimate than love? And we have to understand fear in its proper sense. And let me put it this way. If one give somebody that one loves a gift, so there's a certain amount that goes into it. You put aside the money for the gift, you choose the gift, you wrap the gift, you write a note for the gift, you present the gift. It has, that process has a starting time and it has an ending time. The time from beginning to end might be 10 minutes and the time from beginning to end might be 6 months, but it has a beginning time and it has an end time. If there's something that you know that the person that you love likes and enjoys, and you do it for them, those actions have a beginning time and they have an end time. So you know the person, whatever it is, likes good music, so you'll take them to good music, you'll buy them good music, but each time you'll do it, there's a beginning time, there's an end time. If you know that the person that you like gets irritated by something that you do, And so you watch yourself not to do the things that irritate him or her. What's the beginning time and end time of it? It has no beginning. It's permanent. It's a consciousness of the other that exists all the time, every time. Acts of love have beginning and end times. It's all love. We're not saying that the one is love. It's all love. But now love has two dimensions, two energies to it. The one is out doing something generous. I will go out and do something, and the other is you. Hey, I better watch it, because he doesn't like this, so I won't do it. That's also love. But which is the one that is more continuous? The yira, refraining from doing things that irritate somebody, is more continuous than doing something for somebody. You might do something for somebody many times over and over and over again, but it's rhythmic. You stop. And there might be overlap. You're always doing something with the other person. That's all fine. But it's not the same as an awareness that there's something I like doing or I'm in the habit of doing, and I've got to constantly stop myself from doing because the other person doesn't appreciate it. And if you remember last Monday night, that's what I explained. A parent teaches a baby. Or some babies are fortunate enough to be taught that by parents who are not scared of them. And that is at an early age for the child to start learning, as much as I like to yell in the middle of the night, my mother doesn't like me to yell in the middle of the night, and I therefore must learn to respect that and to restrain myself and not yell unless I really need her. And so as the child grows older, the capacity to hold something in because you're aware of somebody else is, as Hirsch said last Monday night, the essence of sanctity. Because at the end of the day, that's what God is. Hold something back because there's a will that is superior and that doesn't like me doing that particular thing. So as much as I like doing it, I'm not going to do it. And yira, therefore, is a greater demonstration of love than ahava. It is easier to love than it is to fear. And fear is a bad word. What does yira mean? What word does fear, yira, come from? From ra'ah, from seeing. It's interesting, fear probably comes from ear. I don't know if it does or it doesn't. But fear is ear. Fear is like a hearing thing. You only hear when somebody's present. If they're not present, you can't hear them. But vision, you can see somebody even when they're not present. And that's what yira is. Yira is not fear. Fear is, oh, it's coming. But the teacher's coming, the policeman's coming, be careful. Yira is the opposite. Yira is the teacher's not coming, the policeman's not coming, nor is there any chance of him coming. But I can see him, and therefore I won't do it. A famous story with Yosef when he was about to have his relationship with Potiphar's wife, and his father appears to him. His father is thousands of miles away, hundreds of miles away, and he doesn't even know whether his father's alive, but he sees his father's face, and he's able to say, this is not what my father would approve of, and I have enough respect for my father to know, therefore I shouldn't be doing it. Yira is something which enables a baby and an adult to see the presence of a person even when they're not there. And in fact, what facilitates yira? The first time that a baby really understands that is when the baby no longer cries when the mother leaves the room. Why does a baby cry when the mother leaves the room initially when the baby's very small?
He's afraid she won't come back.
He knows she won't come back. Because when she's out of sight, she's dead. He doesn't understand that you can have an existence outside of sight. And only as he learns over and over again. Now the moment he changes or she changes, Josette, you've got a chance now to watch this in action. The moment that changes is when the child can say mama. When the child has a word that he or she can attach to the mother, he can live with the concept even with the absence of the mother. So it is language that facilitates you, that facilitates the ability to vision something that isn't there. And visioning something that isn't there is the essence of loyalty. It's the essence of faithfulness. Faithfulness and loyalty is not to be careful how you act when the other person is looking. Faithfulness is to act exactly the same whether they're looking or they're not looking. Because you see them there, they're with you, whether that's love. Love is that he or she is there, whether or not she is or isn't there. Love is not just when we're together. Love is to be able to feel that intimacy at all time and to behave in the same way. And that's the yira that Shlomo HaMelech, when Shlomo HaMelech says, the laws of the rabbis are more intimate to me than the words of the Torah itself. The Torah's generosity, it's easy for me to study the Torah and practice the Torah. But to restrain myself and say, the Torah says, don't write, you know what? I see God, I see the fear of doing something that could offend him, that could upset him. I'm not even going to touch a pension on Shabbos. Maybe I'll come to that. Why do I want to do that? Why do I want to irritate God? I love him so much. Yiroh is an outcrop of love. Yiroh is not, what will God do? I better not touch a pencil. Yiroh is, I love him so much. Why would I run the risk of irritating him? Move the pencil away, so I won't come near to it. I won't come near to it on Shabbos. That's what the rabbis teach. So if you love him so much, why come near to the irritation? You're in the habit of writing, and you're trying to break a habit on Shabbos. That's difficult. Do things that will help you break the habit so that you don't come to irritating him. And that's why, Yiroh. So when Rashi said in the beginning, Shir Hashirim is holy of holies, because it's all about Yiroh Shemayim, God-fearing, and the acceptance of the yoke of his kingdom. That word Olam, I don't know if yoke is the right word, but it's the responsibility. That element of love is the element that most romantic works omit. You will very seldom find a love poem or a love song or a love anything that talks about the all, the responsibility of being in love. Because being in love means you don't do what irritates the other person. That's the hard part. All the other stuff is easy. Love means writing love letters, and love means giving gifts, and love means loving and hugging and kissing and loving. All of that's easy. That's not the problem. The real challenge of love is breaking habits. The real challenge of love is not doing the things that you've always done and that are natural to you, because the other person doesn't like it. My friend, he just doesn't like it. You don't have to enter into a philosophic debate about why. He just doesn't like it, doesn't enjoy the taste. So you don't do it. That's the all. And in Eicha, there's a verse that says, Tov legevo ki yisa ol min uov. It is very good for a man to take on a yoke when he's young. And the Chazal says, Ezehu ol, what yoke is it talking about? Ol isha, the yoke of the woman. That's the yoke of the woman. Is that how you talk about romance and love and marriage? Yes. Because when it's saying it's good to do it while he's young, what does it mean? Before he gets into habits that he can't break. Then it becomes very, very hard for him to break that. And that's why an older man has difficulty adjusting. Because what does the adjustment mean? Again, the adjustment is not doing new things that you never did before. It's great to do new things that you never did before. That's expanding. But to stop doing things you always used to do, that's hard. And that's what the relationship with God requires. Not just that we do a whole lot of things and we keep Shabbos and we do kashrus and we do that. That's all okay. Also means stopping to do things that we're comfortable doing because Hashem doesn't like them. Now we can engage in a whole discussion, and that's what the learning of Torah is, and why Hashem doesn't like them. But that's almost irrelevant at the point of holding back. What should hold us back is the love. The why, that's very interesting. Afterwards we can have an interesting discussion to figure out why you don't like it, because Hashem is not an emotional being without intellect. Everything he likes and dislikes is for a reason, and we can analyze that reason and understand it, but that's not what drives the action. What should drive the action is, Yiroh, I can see God with me. Why would I want to offend him? Why would I want to do something that irritates him when I love him the way I do? And that's the kind of message that Shlomo is opening his work with in the understanding. And it's a perfect example of using the man-woman relationship to understand the man-God relationship, but equally important, the man-God relationship to understand the man-woman relationship. Are there any questions on that? Because that's a very difficult and a key concept. Really?
It just seems to me when you said that acts of love can be hard and stopping point, but if you have a consciousness of it and you're intent all the time, I don't know that I would agree with that, because as you're going about in the business during the day, you come across something and you think out of love, not out of the pure aspect. Oh, you know,
if
you would like that, I'll
put
that
up. Start and stop. There might be 100 start and stop things that all overlap, so you're conscious all the time. I'm not saying that when you're in the positive mode, there are times when it's not in your head. It is possible that in the positive mode, it is in your head all the time, but the actions themselves. So the restraining from a habit, the faithfulness, for example. So if a man is faithful to his wife, a wife to her husband, that faithfulness is not just that he doesn't go off and have an affair with somebody else. It's that he doesn't get himself into a situation where he even thinks about that. And that's an all the time thing. That's the Yerushalayim, that's the Gedolim. And that's a level of love that goes beyond the positive things that one can do. And the gestures that one can make. So yes, you're right that one can be conscious and therefore doing a lot of things that overlap with each other, and that one's always doing something good, although that's unrealistic. It doesn't usually happen that way. You're busy at work, whatever it is. But the Yiroh Yira, they can be there, the visioning, the consciousness, the awareness. And Yira doesn't mean, and therefore I don't do something. Yira just means, see, just have the vision of intimacy all the time, as if the person is with you all the time. And that will assist one in the way one conducts oneself, both in the man-god relationship and in the interpersonal relationship.
Why is Yira considered to be a vision thing, and it doesn't necessarily need to be action? Because people can refrain from doing things that irritate them, but then they can sit back, and then, so that they can be a start and stop and left. But with the generosity on the left side, that seems to be more finite. When I see a finiteness to both and an infinite.
No, because if you slip back on the Yira, then at that moment you're not loving. At that moment when you slip, you're not loving, you're not seeing the person next to you, because if you did, you wouldn't do it. So at that moment you've cut yourself off and you've isolated yourself. The person who's right in front of you, you wouldn't do it. So at the moment that you slip back in the Yira area, you're not loving. If you're not doing an act of positive love, it doesn't mean you're not loving at that moment. And that's not, you're not always giving gifts, and you're not always hugging, and you're not always saying nice things. You're sometimes at work doing other things. So it's not a flaw in the love if for a few moments in the day the person is not doing something generous to the person he loves. But if it doesn't mean he doesn't love her, he's just busy at the moment. But if the Yira stops at a moment, then he has given that up. So Yira is something which doesn't interfere with anything else one might be doing, because it's like the operating system behind the computer, it's running all the time. Whereas Ahava is action. So you're working your work processor, that's Ahava. You stop working your word processor, you're no longer doing it. But in the background, your operating system's going all the time. It's not interfering with anything. And Yira is like that. The fear of God operates no matter what you're doing. It's in the background. It's there all the time. You're aware of God being present. And if we all felt...
You don't have God? Is that what
you're saying? Yes, sure. At that moment, there's a flaw. At that moment, God's out of your mind. Because if he was really present in your life, you wouldn't do it.
You know,
like you, all of us. That there are times you're out there. And that's why it's an avera. That means at that moment you've put God out of your mind. Or you've at least distanced him. Because if you really felt him with you, close to you, caring about you, feeling sad at what you're doing, why would you do it? So you don't, there's not that emotional feeling isn't there. Intellectually you might know, God's there, I shouldn't be doing this, but I am. So you've intellectually, but the feeling, you're obviously not feeling intimate with God at that moment, otherwise why would you do it? If you have an intimate relationship with God and you know it's hurting him, why would you do it? So clearly at that moment, the fact that it's hurting him, either you don't feel that it's hurting him, or you're not intimate with him. And that's why it's an avera. It's not an avera because of the action. God doesn't care about the action. The action expresses where you're holding in that, at that moment in relationship to him. So,
when you separate emotions, love of God, fear of God, there are also levels that people reach in how they approach a person that they are. I use the term instead of love if you're devoted. When you're devoted to someone, you reach that level where there is not the separation of love or fear. You have this, there's not that even possibility that you say. So I prefer to look at it as someone being devoted to another person.
I think it's a nice idea.
Devoted. This is a way that there's not fear, there's not love, it's beyond that, and all of these things just are a way to let you analyze your own behavior until you get to the point where you reach this emotion.
I mean, that's a nice idea, and I think it's true. Mm-hmm. That love and fear are while you're working on it, but the idea and the goal of choice of where devotion is a nice one is where there's no difference. Not doing something that offends or hurts another person is as loving as doing something that they enjoy. And it's all part of what you call in devotion, and I think that's in Hebrew we call it devakus. Devakus is where you cleave. There's a cleaving, there's such intimacy that you don't feel separate. The separateness is overcome, and then love and fear become one. That's right. Okay. Thanks. So next Friday we won't meet, but the following Friday, please God, we'll meet again. No, is it up already? Okay, yeah, thank you, that's nice. That's good.
And the posting about the light.
Yeah. This morning's traffic now, but no messaging.